This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hello, this is James Naughty. This programme from the Book Club Archive was originally broadcast in 2005. Hello and welcome to Book Club, in which today we're going to probe some of the corners of the brain, which aren't only mysterious to us, but often remain so for those who've spent most of their lives exploring the secrets, like this month's author, Dr. Oliver Sacks. We're talking about his book, The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, surely one of the great titles of our time, conceived about 20 years ago, which is an account of some of the extraordinary things he's confronted as a neurologist. The book is a compendium of cases that are quite startling, of the man of the title, Dr. P, whose brain has changed in such a way that he does mistake his wife for a hat, but lives a surprisingly normal life, not really knowing that anything's wrong. Or the twins, who have an almost magical gift for calculation and understanding numbers, a gift that disappears, disturbingly, when they're separated. This is a casebook that is medical in one sense, but which owes much of its popularity to the fact that it asks disturbing questions about what makes us what we are, and how the senses that shape our lives sometimes play strange tricks. In our audience of readers here in Bush House, we have some doctors, we've even got a professor of neuroscience, we've got students and listeners who came to us from the charity Connect, which works with people who have suffered some form of brain damage. So we've got people who've lived through the kinds of conditions that Dr. Sacks describes in the book. Oliver Sacks, a very warm welcome to Book Club. It's a fascinating book, not only for professionals, but for those who find themselves drawn to the mysteries of the brain. How did you come to decide that there was an audience for science presented in this way?
Well, I grew up in a house of medical stories and storytelling. My parents were doctors, and I would often see my mother enchant the milkman or the dustman with medical stories. I think that everyone has a right to know what goes on in medicine, and in accessible but non-condescending language.
One of the fascinating things to me is that you were absorbed at a very early age by the business of dissection, which to most of us is rather gory. But there you were, almost watching the business of the brain being pulled apart.
Yes, I was, although I'm surprised that others should be surprised. It seemed to me quite reasonable. And, you know, one knows that Flaubert, at the age of 8, with his little sister, would watch his father dissecting.
In your case, it was your mother?
It was my mother, and I was a little older than that. But my mother was an enthusiast, an anatomist, a surgeon, and perhaps it didn't seem too strange. But there's obviously been a sort of shockwave since I mentioned that in Uncle Tungsten. People would often say to me over the years, hey, what about a case history on yourself? And in a sense, my memoir, Uncle Tungsten, is a case history of myself, of that odd little boy born in the 30s and evacuated in the war and crazy for chemistry.
Let's bring our readers in. You have a question.
The case of Dr. P is clearly taken directly from your clinical experience. To what extent do the patients in your books represent individuals that you have treated, as opposed to being an amalgamation of patients with the classical signs of a particular condition?
They're never amalgamations. They're always individuals. Perhaps occasionally I might import a feature, but they're really not conflations.
You're a student, I think, aren't you? You're a medical student. How did you first come to the book and what did you make of it?
Well, I'm at Cambridge and Cambridge has a very strong neurobiology course and it was actually recommended as part of our course. You might be pleased to know that it's being strongly recommended because you were actually at Oxford, weren't you?
Yeah.
Oh, well, let's not get into these minor medieval disputes. Let's get a flavour of the kinds of cases that the book discusses and the revelations it has. Give us a reading. I think this is from the case of Mr. P, who gave the book its marvellous title. Perhaps you can tell us how the title came about, because it's a cracking title.
I was doing a neuropsychology class with a colleague of mine, and he turned to me at one point, this was in 1983 or so, and said, Oliver, have you had any cases of visual agnosia you'd like to tell the students. And I said, well, yeah, I said there was this chap, Dr. P. He was a musician, a very eminent musician, who developed a strange visual problem, became unable to recognise the faces of people around him. He recognised their voices perfectly well, but he had difficulty with visual recognition, first of faces and then more generally, and so that he was in a state of bizarre visual confusion, although not entirely aware of this. And I said, and at one point, actually, when he went to get his hat, he got his wife's head instead, and so he mistook his wife for a hat. And the students laughed, and my colleague said to me, why don't you write this up? And so I wrote up the case history that night, and that's how the title came about, but it was purely something spontaneous and something which actually happened.
And in a curious way, the title produced the book.
Yes.
Give us a reading of the case of Dr. P.
Well, this is just a little fragment. I showed Dr. P the cover of National Geographic magazine, which is an unbroken expanse of Sahara dunes. What do you see here? I asked. I see a river, he said, and a little guest house with its terrace on the river. People are dining out on the terrace. I see coloured parasols here and there. He was looking, if it was looking, right off the cover, into mid-air, and confabulating non-existent features, as if the absence of features in the actual picture had driven him to imagine the river and the terrace and the coloured parasols. I must have looked aghast, but he seemed to think he had done rather well. There was a hint of a smile on his face. He also appeared to have decided that the examination was over, and started to look around for his hat. He reached out his hand and took hold of his wife's head, tried to lift it off, to put it on. He had apparently mistaken his wife for a hat. His wife looked as if she was used to such things. I could make no sense of what had occurred in terms of conventional neurology or neuropsychology. In some ways, he seemed perfectly preserved. In others, absolutely, incomprehensibly devastated. How could he, on the one hand, mistake his wife for a hat, and on the other, function, as apparently he still did, as a teacher at the music school?
Yes.
Could you tell us something about how the audience that you envisage determines the way that you write? How does the man who mistook his wife for a hat differ from the way you would write that up in a medical journal? I'm very struck by how much dialogue there was in the little snippet that you just read us. Yeah. Dialogue between doctors and patients is very unusual to find in clinical case histories. How has dialogue become so prominent in your own writing?
Basically, I think I extend a case history into a sort of biography. I put it in a broader and broader context. I want to display the individual and not just the pathology. As for dialogue, I think I've become better at dialogue than I was in Hat. I think some of the dialogue is, frankly, is rather clumsy. I now try and get people's words exactly. Gowers, who was a founder figure in neurology in the 19th century, in fact invented a form of shorthand because he thought it was tremendously important to get patients' exact words. And I think that the story which the patient tells needs to be presented in those words. I will say here that, amongst other things, I think I was considerably influenced by the Sherlock Holmes stories.
It's hard to read this book without feeling that it's in some respects a plea for humanity.
I think that medicine needs to be tender, tactful, and at times lyrical, as well as precise and analytical. I don't think that these compete with one another, or need to.
Because it should be said about the book that it is a kind of celebration of life in different forms, isn't it?
I feel that my theme is survival, and survival under extraordinarily different conditions. It's not about disease, but certainly Dr. P, who was so incapacitated visually, nonetheless had a very rich life.
And didn't have a problem with his condition.
No, he seemed curiously unconcerned by it, which somewhat puzzled me, because he was a very acute man in other ways.
We have another question here.
You treat and write about some very, very disabling conditions, but with all the things that can go wrong with our neurological systems, I wondered if you thought that we might all have impairments to some degree. something wrong with our neurological system in some way or to some degree?
Well, I don't know whether impairment is the right term, but certainly we all differ in our relative strengths and weaknesses. I felt this very, very early. Because, for example, my father was extremely musical. He would come back from concerts and play everything by ear and transpose them and play Bach in a Bartokian way and vice versa. I'm moderately musical, but nowhere near him. My mother had strong sort of visual and mechanical powers. I remember once I brought back a lizard from our museum at school, and my mother looked at this carefully and put it down and drew the lizard skull, mentally rotated it through 15 degrees and did it again, and did a series of a dozen drawings. My own visual imagery is poor. And then my eldest brother was very good at languages. I'm hopeless. And so some of my earliest experiences were of relative impairment. I may then have just found one or two strengths. Incidentally, I'm almost incapable of recognizing faces myself. Kate, who works with me, has to warn people. She said, I've worked with him for 20 years and sometimes he doesn't recognize me. I had actually two episodes recently. One was when I walked into a lavatory and almost bumped into a large, clumsy man. I started to apologize, then realized it was a mirror. Then there was a couple of weeks after this, I was sitting at outside a restaurant. The window was to my right. And, you know, if you have a beard, you know, there's a tendency to preen yourself. And I looked into the reflection, and then I realised my reflection was not preening itself.
But I should say your beard looks very neat and tidy tonight.
Right, yes. But there was a puzzled man inside the restaurant with a beard who wondered why I was doing this. So I can't even recognise myself, and so I'm very attuned to Dr. P. I think in a way the conditions I describe are not that unusual. I don't want them to be seen as sort of as exotica.
I'd like to know what for you would be one of the most frightening aspects of the human brain.
Frightening, there's a word.
One of the most frightening aspects, physically, it's vulnerability. Although it's pretty well cushioned, but as an ardent backstroke swimmer, I'm always hitting myself with a crash on the pool and sort of knocking out a few million neurons each time, no doubt.
Do you worry? Do you worry when you do that?
Slightly. I mean, I may be getting to the end of my reserve. I don't know.
One of the things I wondered about in a number of the stories was about the borderline between different medical specialties. In The Disembodied Lady, you bring in a psychiatrist to find out whether she's suffering from a psychiatric problem, and the conclusion is that, no, it returns to you for diagnosis. And you bring in other specialists at other moments, and it's that borderline between them that I'm interested in.
This was a case where the person felt utterly disconnected, remote from the body.
She lost her ability to move her body entirely.
Yeah, and felt almost disembodied. Well, whenever there are sort of ambiguous symptoms, which could be neurological or psychiatric, I'm eager to get the opinion of my psychiatric colleague. I discussed this in another book of mine, A Leg to Stand On, when I sort of, following a nerve injury, developed a leg which was paralysed and seemed alien to me and not mine. I wondered if this was a form of hysteria. Indeed, I hoped it was a form of hysteria. And I was rather disturbed when the psychiatrist said, no, I don't think it is. But I think often I need the special expertise of others, including, I think, often therapists of one sort or another, occupational therapists, physiotherapists. I think one may need the resources of a team, but finally there has to be a single person who is who is interacting with the patient.
You're listening to Book Club on BBC Radio 4 with Dr. Oliver Sacks discussing his book, The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. You alluded there to the time at which you were a patient yourself. I'm interested, because we have some doctors in the audience, what they took from the book about the doctor-patient relationship, something which we've all pondered from time to time.
What strikes me about the stories in The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat is that they are, as you say, very human. There's tremendous humanity in them, and that seems to me to reside in the thoughts of the doctor we learn a lot about your response as doctor author to the patient, your concern for the patient, your wondering about how the patient is feeling, your attempts to understand the patient from the patient's viewpoint. And what is so interesting is that the modern case history strips all this away. In the modern case history, the patient might have their voice at the very beginning. They may be quoted for one or two sentences verbatim, but the rest of the case history treats the patient as a passive object. The patient could actually be a piece of geological specimen.
One of the things that comes up time and again, it seems to me, is this taking time. And increasingly in modern medicine, both in America and here, with managed care there and with the pressure from the government to see more patients in less time, we as doctors really find it very difficult to take time. We're under so much pressure. And without time, it is almost impossible to be humane, to negotiate. Yeah. And it's something that I think we really need to hang on to. And we need spokesmen like yourself to encourage patients not only to expect that from us, but to make it accessible as a possible option for doctors.
Yes, I think the question of time is absolutely crucial. I'm rather spoilt myself and that I'm not under too many pressures. But I know many years ago, for example, when I worked in a migraine clinic, there was considerable pressure. One should see every patient in a few minutes. You should see as many patients as possible. Otherwise, the clinic wouldn't survive financially. I don't know what the answer is. Although it may be that some of the technical achievements now which allow patients' experiences and case histories to, you know, I think there are electronic libraries of this, but I don't know what the answer is.
What worries me as well is that every time I go to some talk in public where people like yourself speak, someone, often several people in the audience, relate what seem to me catastrophic miscommunications, which are a product of a lack of time, that happen at moments in people's lives which will mark them forever. Yeah. And this seems to be the other side of the medical discourse.
Right. Well, I certainly felt that when I was a patient myself. I describe it a bit in my book, A Leg to Stand On, where I couldn't communicate my condition or what I felt to be my condition or my experience or my fears to the surgeon.
Hello, Dr. Schacht. I'm a person from Connect. I'm sales people with aphasia. I have aphasia.
Can you just tell us, for those who don't know, who are listening, how you would describe aphasia?
It's a continuum. On one side, have people who can speak, like me. On the other side, have people who can't speak. I have difficulty with words, yeah. In the presence of speech, it's a lot of roar of laughter coming from the ward for people with aphasia at the present on TV, yeah? Proving you can't lie to a person with aphasia. I wonder, have the conditions changed in the 20 years since you wrote the book? Have made your mind take a different course, particularly with this view of people with receptive aphasia?
I don't know whether you yourself have any receptive aphasia as well as the expressive, but I think people with aphasia will discover often that their powers of gesture and mimesis and of understanding gesture and mimesis are preserved and may become heightened. And there was, in fact, fairly recently, and I was pleased to see it because, sometimes I suffer from the feeling that various things are dismissed as, oh, this is one of Sachs's stories. Ha ha, you know. But there was an interesting study which was published in Nature of the ability of a group of 20 aphasic people to detect lies, 20 aphasics, and it was a carefully controlled double-blind study, and in fact this was found. And so I think I will sort of hold to this.
Yes, I too have aphasia too. I found it really difficult to read your book. I cried quite a lot. But what came again for me is your humanity again. But what I liked is the promise and the potential that you see. That's why I cried, because I've got that from you.
You mean it's an optimistic book in the end, isn't it?
Yes.
Well, though I hope realistic as well. It so happens that I've actually just been writing, I've just written another, quite a long case history of a patient of mine whom I've known for many years with an almost total expressive aphasia. She really cannot utter a single word, but her ability to communicate one way and another is very remarkable. Partly she does this by having a book of several hundred words arranged in 20 or 30 categories and pointing to the category she needs.
I was extraordinarily moved, in particular with, there was one patient you described with a tic, and that you didn't just say you prescribed haloperidol, just a small amount, and he said that he wasn't the same after. He said it took away some of his symptoms, but he said he wasn't the same without his tic. And your capacity to listen to him and actually understand what his experience was, and not just implement something as opposed as a force, but to listen to him, I thought was amazing. How has your capacity to listen and to try to understand changed from this book? And what has developed in how you've understood the not only just the cold subjective experience, but being with another person?
Yeah, incidentally, this patient, Wichitikuwe, is still my patient 33 years later. He's become a friend as well, and I've gone to his son's bar mitzvahs and so forth, although one mustn't treat one's friends, but sometimes a patient will become a friend after a long while, although I think you both have to be assured that medical judgment will still be there and not sort of biased by this. But certainly there, it was very crucial for him to take part in the decision. I mean, together we negotiated a solution that he would take Haldol in the week and be sort of rather damped down by it, but take himself off it and sort of let fly over weekends. A third of a century later, he still does this. Mm-hmm. His children, in a way, have had to grow up knowing their father in two aspects, as a rather sort of dull, solid citizen from Monday to Friday, and as a wild, Dionysiac, frenetic, Touretic over the weekends.
I wonder if I could ask you about your view of medical ethics. You note at one point you saw a super Touretta, as you called her, walking down the street, and you obviously didn't feel that you could go up to her and accost her and ask her if she would come into the clinic for tests, yet you do feel it appropriate to write about your patients and put them into a popular book.
Remind us, before we get into the ethical question there, the super Touretta, it's an extraordinary story. Describe the case.
People with Tourette's, in general, they are accelerated, impulsive, and I think often imitative, and they're exceedingly sensitive and incontinently reactive to external and internal stimuli of various sorts. And in particular, this was an old woman who involuntarily or compulsively, whichever, or incontinently, echoed people's voices, imitated their gestures and their postures.
At an extraordinary speed.
At great speed. And then when they were aghast, she would echo their aghastness.
And from the ethical perspective, did you feel guilty watching her in the street?
No, I do watch people quietly. Once I was here in Bush House. Is this Bush House?
It is.
Right. And when I left, there was a taxi with a violently Touretic taxi driver.
We've all met them.
Yeah. I thought, well, gosh, isn't that nice? My publishers have, secured this man for me. I mean, at one point at a traffic light, he got out and jumped on the bonnet of the car and waved his arms and shouted and then got back in. And after a while, I made some comment, and he got rather offended, and he turned round and he said, I don't have anything, and I'll thank you to keep your mouth shut, sir. And I sort of felt I had trespassed. Right at the end, he did say, what did you call it? But he, in fact, had never regarded himself as having anything. And here I was, this intrusive person at the back, sort of making diagnoses, playing the doctor. But in particular, you bring up the ethics of writing about people. I will say, for a long while, whenever I used to misread the word portrayal as betrayal, and publish as punish. I wondered if I was exploiting people and exposing them in an unethical way.
And what did you conclude?
I get as much consent, free consent, uncoerced consent as I can. But in general, I can only hope that if I describe people in the mode of appreciation and respect and tenderness and tact, that will make it okay. But it's a fine line.
Are those of you who are involved in medicine in any way convinced by that?
Yes, I'm very convinced by it, but interestingly, modern medical journal editors are not, and now in order to publish case histories, one has to have signed, written patient consent, and very frequently, and I think in a way this is an interesting development, the patients, some journals now insist that patients and doctors co-author case histories. Mm. They are actually jointly written.
Yeah. Incidentally, there are then further problems if what one writes, one's case history, is then turned into a film or an opera or something like this. I felt nervous when the man who mistook his wife for a hat was turned into an opera, or there was a suggestion for this, and I said to Michael Nyman and his librettist, you must go and speak to Mrs. P and discuss this, which they did. In fact, Mrs. P is portrayed much more fully and warmly in the opera than in the case history. I saw the opera performed in Lincoln Center. I was sort of hiding in the side and watching Mrs. P and wondering what she was thinking. But at the end, she came up to us. Her husband had died in the interim. She said, you have done honor to my husband. That made me feel a lot better.
Anyone else with a last... Yes, here. I think you're a GP, aren't you?
Yes, but it's a slightly more frivolous question in a way.
GPs are allowed to be frivolous from time to time.
Do you think that mistaking one's wife for a hat would be grounds for divorce?
Well, she seemed remarkably accepting of it.
Yes.
And there, on that happy note, discussing an optimistic book, we leave it. Oliver Sacks, thank you very much indeed for being our guest on Book Club today. We look forward to being with you next month with the next book.
We hope you've enjoyed this Radio 4 podcast. You can find hundreds of other programmes at bbc.co.uk/Radio 4.